So welcome to the month three investable ETR briefing. And we're presenting today the period that covers from the 1st of March to the 31st of March. So last month was the anniversary of our first briefing back in 2020. And trade, as with life, remains a challenge for us all, particularly when we can see our colleagues in England are already starting to show early signs of a return to normal. Like the UK, trade in March saw the UK shake off some of the rut the year began with, and we have to be thankful for that. Anyway, welcome to the briefing, quarter one's briefing that is, and let's look into how the improved performance actually looks like in black and white. As the briefing document explains, exchange traded receivables are leases, monetary obligations are bills issued under contract for assets, goods and services that are supplied to investment quality companies or credit insured invoices from investment grade insurers. What this means is that an ETR is evidence of a debt owing from one company to another. Typically, these tend to be large companies or banks that are household names, and they owe money to their smaller micro to medium-sized suppliers. We call these micro to medium-sized suppliers businesses originators because they originate the debt obligation transaction that creates the ETR that are traded on the exchange. The ETR is evidence of the large company's liability to pay the smaller one, and credit exchange by these ETR at a nominal discount to their face value. In doing so, when the ETR are settled or paid in full, the difference between the face value that is settled and the discounted price that it was purchased at creates a margin. And it's that margin that creates the yield or return for investors. Credit exchange also provides credit facilities to other types of transactions, such as trade finance, asset finance, and others. Essentially, they all work on the same principles that the traded ETR is a business transaction. The exchange provides liquidity, and it's paid a commission for doing so, much in the same way a bank charges interest. As the briefing states, at the end of March, Credit Exchange held active RSA of 18.54 million. As you all know, RSA stands for Revolving Sale Agreed, and a revolving sale agreement is a document or contract between the micro to medium-sized business or the originator and Credit Exchange. The revolving sale agreement is a commitment by the originator to sell a certain value of ETR to the exchange in any given period, typically for 1 year, let's say. For example, let's say there's an originator needs a revolving credit facility of $250,000 in order to run their business. They'll come to a credit exchange, much like they would a bank, and apply for that credit facility. If we agree to offer them the $250,000 on a revolving basis every 60 days, they must agree to sell us $250,000 worth of ETR every 60 days, and the revolving sale agreement, or RSA, will be for $1.5 million worth of ETR over a 12-month period. This commitment to sell the $1.5 million of ETR annually to the exchange is documented in the RSA with Credit Exchange. As stated, at the end of March, Credit Exchange held 18.54 million of these active RSA contracts. Active RSA contracts continue to remain short as trading patterns, speed of settlement, and the shortening of the cash-to-cash life cycle increases. This is due to the ever-increasing use of letters of credit or LCs in our business. And trade finance in its purest form, supporting commodity trades and shipping related transactions, is now a core activity on the trade desk. As we look like we're pulling out of first gear and push on into the remainder of 2021. Last month, I mentioned the significant increase in leasable assets over the 12 months of 2020. There's been a marginal increase in leasable assets since December, but indications from shipping is that the careful investigation of this market last year and our official entry into the shipping sector in quarter four of 2020 is about to pay dividends. Shipping is a volatile market and also unique. Despite the fact that March was our sixth month operating in the market, we have declined to trade more than 30 opportunities. Those of you that have seen the Trade Credit website will notice that we've recruited two seasoned advisors in that market. Together, they manage the Bank of Ireland Shipping Assets desk over 8 years. They built that book to over €1 billion in assets before being instructed to sell off the same book in 2009. This took them a further 7 years, and we're grateful to have their insight complementing our own credit team's risk assessment and trade monitoring skills. Essentially, once you understand the unique aspects of shipping, and there are many, I can assure you, the rudimentary and fundamental basics of loan to value, cash to value, red book value principles, they all remain. Unlike almost any other asset, a ship has a mark to market value, a replacement value, and a cash flow, or what they call Hamburg value. They're all directly affected by freight rates, fuel costs, regulatory conditions on speed and emissions, consumer stance on ESG, currency movements, commodity prices, geopolitical events, and even natural events. So navigating this market, so excuse the pun on that one, navigating this market is not for the faint-hearted. Our extensive research, combined with our conservative approach and our experience in trade finance, have all brought us to bear as we identify market weaknesses that will benefit most from our financial strength and experience. As of March, we still remain on the sidelines, waiting patiently for the correct opportunities from the better operators in the market. And the market has suffered badly since 2008. And that's not to say we see the Baltic Index getting back to its halcyon days at 10,000 plus mark. But we do believe there's a lot of capacity to move from its current levels, which are reminiscent of 1995. For those of you who don't know, this shipping index had its two lowest values in January of 2016 and June of last year, where it was below 500. Currently at circa 2,300, and given the market's reawakening in the last few months, we see it climbing and remaining over the 3,000 level this year. Indeed, Reuters reported earlier this week that the dry index that tracks rates for Capesize, Panamax, and Supermax vessels rose 2% to 2,432, and this is the highest level since September 2019. We've also started monitoring future freight agreements, or FFA markets. These are derivative financial instruments that are traded in Germany and Singapore, and although they're a pure futures trade, they are used by cargo owners and ship owners alike.
Patrick, can I just ask, how does, and you have been mentioning shipping for a couple of months, mm-hmm. how does that fit in with, the ETRs that make up the index? Is it that they will provide another stream of ETRs or?
Well, 90% of the ETRs that we are buying are products. So when we are talking about our Irish, our English, what we call our indigenous market, shipping is irrelevant, largely speaking.
Yeah.
But when you start to move outside of Ireland and England, which we started doing in 2019, then you are looking at international trade. An international trade, 90% of it, at some point ends up on a ship. So, yes, we have two products. We have investable ETR and leasable ETR. So investable ETR is 90 plus percent of our business in any given year. but there's still a 10% remaining leasable ETR, which is assets. So we have, as you may know, mining or quarrying assets in the UK, which is large plant and machinery that's used for crushing stone that ultimately is used by people like CRH, JPE, which is a large privately owned company, Tarmac and the like. So those assets are leasable assets, but shipping assets, physical ships, we are very much looking at. Because they are, if you examine the market for as long as we have, a ship that is 10 years, is brand new or 10 years old in certain markets. So it's called the short sea market. So going from Ireland to England or going up along the coasts of Northern Europe, that's called coastal shipping. So a coastal ship, brand new, would cost anywhere between 20 and 30 million. You can buy a 15, 17-year-old vessel at maybe 4.5 million, and yet it's still got another, anywhere between 15 and 25 years of serviceable life in it. But the problem is that all of the English banks, the majority of the German banks, also Dutch banks, all got into that market at the absolute peak and completely wiped themselves out. So talking to a chap this morning, Deutsche Bank, it's going to take them years to recover from the billions of euros they have lost. ABN AMRO, something similar. Bank of Scotland, the same. So very few banks made money in that market because they entered late, bought assets at the top of their value, and then suddenly they collapsed. Where have we heard that before? So we have been looking at this market very specifically in the 15 years or older market. And in that market, there are endless numbers of ship owners and shipping companies that have very valuable, serviceable routes, but they cannot buy the vessels because they cannot find the banks to finance them. So we're talking about people who are providing services to Total or to Shell and others. They have the contracts, but they can't physically buy the vessel. Now, they don't want to buy a new one, which plenty of banks will finance, because there isn't enough margin in buying a new one. But if they buy one that's 15 or 16 years old, well, probably a bit old for the oil industry, but if they were providing services to timber companies, etc., on the short sea, there is endless amount of opportunities for them. This market hasn't seen a recovery it's been in the doldrums for the last 13 years and has recovered substantially, literally in the last, say, 3-6 months. So we have been watching this market very, very carefully, simply because if shipping and the cost of shipping is rising, that means the products that's sitting on them is rising, which means that we're seeing a return back to normality, whatever that is, back to September 2019. So that means there's going to be more movement of goods, because we had to look outside Ireland. We were doing it anyway in 2019. Certainly focused the mine in 2020. So a lot of our view now is on what products are moving from market A to market B, how is shipping working, what is the return on shipping assets, and what happens when you get into that market, how do you finance it? So, for example, you're financing a car, you know that you can sell that car at this price at that year. How do you apply that same logic into shipping, etc.? So the long answer to your question I've just given, the short answer is trade finance touches shipping. They live in the same domain. And by watching what's going on in that market, we can better direct our efforts into markets that will give returns on investable ETR And we are looking at leasable ETR assets that will involve, as I say, ships that are 10, 15 years old. I hope that's adequately.
Thanks, Patrick. Yeah, it does indeed.
Great. Just to add a little bit extra to that, I was just saying about future freight agreement or FFA markets. A futures market is just telling you that the price of corn today is X, and in September it's X plus 10%. Freight agreements tell you that shipping from Brazil to China today is $18,000 a day today, but if you try and book it in June, for example, it's $20,000 a day. So that tells you the market is looking favorable towards trade. So we're just watching all of these indicators. We still have not changed what we do. We still buy receivables payable by large companies. That hasn't and won't change. But we're just looking at larger companies in different countries, like, for example, Trafigura, Cargill. These are large commodity companies who we are going to buy receivables with that they have to pay. So we like that, just the same way as we like Dunn Stores or Total Produce. Anyway, to return back to what I was talking about, these are derivative financial instruments traded in Germany and Singapore, and although they're a pure futures trade, they are used by cargo owners and ship owners, as I would say. Also, there are probably very few practical users of these instruments in the real world. They are a strong indicator of trade flow in general, hence the reason why we watch them. So the European Energy Exchange, or the EEX, that's a subsidiary of the Deutsche Börse, where it handled record levels of dry freight futures, there's a tongue twister, in the first quarter of the year, boosted by its highest ever monthly volume in March. Volumes also rose by 67% in the first 3 months of the year, up from 187 lots in 220 to 314,000 in last month. These are not just financial plays. These are indicative of a market that is predicting, at the very least, strong short-term growth as congestion and supply chains start to ease as trade returns to normal. In other words, as pent-up trade and production flow back into the market, the demands on shipping will be sustained for at least the next 3 to 4 years is the guess, unless, of course, large-scale war disrupts it in some way. Which is all very interesting when we talk of next month, next quarter, and next year. But right now, at the end of March, we remain excited and cautious as we seek to make our first transactions in that market. However, as we hadn't made any asset trades in that sector, the leasable assets remained slightly above those of year end from last year. As this briefing is about March's trades, thankfully the disappointing results from January and February did not follow us into the end of quarter three. March picked up its pace, but overall the effect of January and February left us with trade results only marginally higher than those of 2016. March, being the beginning of spring, brought us the first green shoots of returning to the strong growth of 2020. We'll have to see what April briefing brings us. But more importantly, March saw us shake off concerns that our trading style was out of sync with the markets, that we weren't adapting to it, or that possibly we were in the wrong part of the market. None of this held true, and my insistence that we held our line and remained steadfast in our determination not to trade for trade's sakes looks to have been the right decision. The market, so our market, did wake up, and without wanting to spook the future outlook, I think we are witnessing more than just positive shoots of growth. but I don't want to dwell on that too much. I prefer reporting actual results rather than predicting future ones. Real numbers on real trades are what we're judged on, not on what we can predict. For those of you who missed last month's briefing and the parallels between 2020-2021 and 2019-2020-2021, the good news indicators continue. One of the world's more famous shipping economists, a chap called Martin Stafford, has put a dollar figure estimate that shipping will need to spend on that shipping will need to spend on the global merchant fleet over the course of the next 30 years. They'll have to increase it by several trillion. So anyway, returning back to the last 3 months have been the best 3 months for shipping and trading in general for the last 13 years, with soaring rates and a bounce back in world trade. So this performance appears to bring the industry back to days that are starting to look like 2008, which means that they should be starting to come back into our market, local market, that is. So the stocks in places like Wall Street in these areas have risen by almost 40% in the first quarter of this year. Also helped by a wider market confidence on the back of the huge U.S. public spending package and the prospect of further low interest rates. There's some concern on the Federal Reserve talking about letting inflation rise above 2%. And in Hamburg, the container monthly report for March states the first indications of governments led by the US and the UK are starting to work on plans to raise taxes, as the huge debt the various governments around the world have built up need to be repaid at some stage. So this will obviously also have some impact on business recovery. Let me return to that towards the end of the briefing, because I do want to actually get your collective opinions on what we're doing between now and the end of May. But returning to the briefing, it states that there were 23.16 million of fully allocated funds, and this is a slight increase on February's figure. What this fully allocated figure means is that the exchange held 23.16 million worth of ETR at the end of March. When you take that 23.16 worth of that means that there was 23.16 worth of investors' funds in the market at that day. If you add that then to the 18.54 million of RSA, or revolving sale agreements, that represent the future orders we have in our books, that totals almost 42 million. And as a result, this reverses the downward trend from the first 2 months of the year. So my comment about the exchange showing early signs of recovery are borne out in this number alone. Last month, I mentioned the board's view was that our current stance is correct and that the beginning of the year was a fair performance in adverse market conditions and that there was no basis for changing our position. Moving on to the next figure, March's briefing shows that investors redeemed almost 2 million euro in March. And this was unusually high for this time of year and can be attributed possibly to the lowering yield at circa 1.70%, which carried through from the end of February. As you can see under the trend section, this has reversed and returned upwards, and we expect this to continue for most, if not all, of this second quarter. The ratio of money in versus money out in March was also out of its norm, where it was 1-2, meaning more funds left the exchange than came in. So for every 2 euros that left the exchange, only one was coming in. This is not a concern because overall for the quarter, the ratio was 1-1, meaning there was neither growth nor decline in the investors' funds. and that suited the market because of the low activity in January and February. These investors' funds, as you know, are a mixture of private companies using ETR as a safe haven for their cash, and an even split of pension funds in the form of ARF, PRBs and PRSAs, and of course private investor savings. The current economic and social crisis remains good for investable ETR, with continued liquidity and stability in our market as we continue on into the second quarter of 2021. This then brings the focus of this briefing to the ETR average duration figure of 121 days. And this number, as you know, is what we call the credit index. It's the ETR average duration and number of days it takes for an ETR to get settled. So the number has been stable at the mid 90 mark, but in February it increased 10% to 105. And this increase is another 15% increase during March. So the exchange's average credit index is 75 days. And what we're seeing is a further move away from the norm to 121, or over 60% slower settlement. And this continues, obviously, to hurt the micro to medium-sized business sector that we serve. Our indigenous markets, being Ireland and England, UK more correctly, continue to suffer despite the backdrop of recovering sectors like shipping, commodities, and international trade. So the credit index is the ETR average duration, or number of days it takes for an ETR to get settled. So cash to cash cycle from the day the ETR is purchased and the number of days it takes for the debt to be extinguished or settled and the cash returned. So at 121 days, we're again looking at some distance away from the all-time high of 134 days from June of last year. But obviously, you need to keep an eye on that. Specifically, the 25% increase over the past 2 months means that originators are feeling increased pressure on their cash flow, and their revolving credit facility requirements they've had some stability on recently, it would seem, is starting to slide backwards. As explained at every briefing, the credit index is an economic indicator of the current global depression, I would say, that our market is operating in. Returning back to March's briefing, there's the trading result of 3.9 million in February. That was, again, very, very poor when you compare it to what was going on in 2020. But thankfully, in March, this rose to 10.11 million. So a 250% increase, which was welcomed. Below this, then, in the next paragraph, you will see the treasury performance at 9.21 million. This means that we spent roughly 10 million and collected over 9. This is more like it, more like what we're used to. So we are happiest when trade and treasury are aligned, meaning we're collecting almost as quickly as we're spending. This also helps counter the overbalance of cash that followed us into 2021 from December of last year. As always and every day, the trade desk and treasury continue to monitor this trade balance of funds, funds in versus funds out, to ensure it remains stable and within the control parameters set down by the credit risk policy that governs the risk and general exchange trading practices in the company. Moving to the center of the document, this is where we list the 10 largest investable ETR holdings and the top 10 rated holdings. These two lists show that companies or organization owed the this list shows what companies or organizations owed the exchange the largest amounts of money as at the end of March. And as usual, you can see HSE, Huawei continue to hold their slots for over a year now. We can also see repeated appearances of Atradius and Vodafone and Cork City Council. CBRE also makes a return after a long absence, as does Shepherd Building, along with some other newcomers. Moving to the top 10 rated investable ETF on the right side, there's the regular reappearance of MediaMath, LG Sky, and others. These are the highest rated debtors, but as none of these were investment grade at 31st of March, it's just showing a random selection of the most creditworthy, I would call it. The pie chart below that continues to demonstrate a significant change in the typically well-diversified spread of ETR across the market. The HSE here in Ireland, the NHS in the UK, along with others in the health and community, did not push forward to the April 2020 high of 25%. Rather, it fell back to 18.67 in February and to 14.86 in March, which is more in line with December's numbers. Since Q2 of last year, the pie chart has a repeated heavy exposure to wholesale and retail. And as per prior statements throughout last year's briefings, this is more wholesale and food-related retail activities. As you may well know, Dunstores, Musgraves, and others make regular appearances on our top 10 largest holdings. Looking at the wholesale trade, this continues to perform well and has remained between 35 to 40% for the past 12 months now. Food and beverage held steady at 7.43%, I should say, in March, with both manufacturing and the business and services sector also holding steady at between 7 and 10% each. The more than 50% decline in construction remained at 7% in March, with no other significant changes being recorded. The pie chart still continues to use the EU NACE categorization system, and as we will get our credit machine operating, according to a meeting Andrew and I had today, we're looking at something closer to the 1st of July, Andrew. That's when we will be expecting to start using the credit classification. So returning to the actual performance of the exchange in March of 2020 versus March 2021, you can see that although we're still more than 17% lower in trading values, there was a significant improvement in March, where we were up almost 60%. The less important lower volume of 30% remains a carryover from February, and as mentioned earlier, the total amount of investors' withdrawals was 1.85 million. And this left the money in versus money out with no material change for quarter one. I've also discussed the credit index at 121 days, being off its base by more than 60%. And as a further disimprovement, obviously, on the 95 mark that opened the year. As explained in the investable brochure and also at other briefings, the average value of an ETR is €2,000. But we had the largest single trade was a trade finance deal of 0.59 million during the month of March. Moving to the trends section of the briefing, the investors' yield or buy price during March started at 1.737, having reached its lowest level in several years, began to climb again, ending at 1.766. We ended the quarter as we started and continued to be overstocked in cash. The issues with new originations saw a considerable uplift from 4 million to 10 million in the month of March. And this explains why the investor yield remained depressed. Nonetheless, as the briefing states, when you compare this to the negative almost 1% yield on bank deposits, investors are getting a yield that is 2.75% better from exchange traded receivables on demand cash equivalent offered by the exchange than they would on their bank deposit. As you all know, this rate changes daily and can be checked anytime on the investable.com website. And to finish this briefing, you will see a repeat of the RSA, or revolving sale agreement, of 18.54. And that concludes this month's briefing for March 2021.